Welcome again to the Cannabis Investing Podcast, where we speak with C-level executives, scientists, and law and sector experts to provide actionable investment insights and the context with which to understand the burgeoning cannabis industry. I'm your host, Rena Sherbel. Hi again, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Welcome to the beginning of June. Hope everybody's doing well. Super excited to bring you today's episode, talking to Graham Farrar, who you might say we knew him when. We've been talking to Graham almost since the inception of the Cannabis Investing Podcast, talking to him mostly through Cadiz and his JV with Cadiz to grow hemp, that part of the cannabis plant, the non-THC side. Talking today mostly about going public via the SPAC with Mercer Park, Jonathan Sandelman, a friend of the show's other vehicle aside from Air Wellness. Also their deal with the parent company, and just talking about how I've dubbed him the kingmaker of California. He's certainly making a claim for the top spot in California cannabis in terms of being on the top consolidators' radars. And he talks about that today, how he sees the future of U.S. cannabis, California in particular, a little bit in the global picture, but really a California U.S.-centric episode from one of the top players to do it. And we have a number of other exciting episodes coming up in the coming days and weeks, including our master class of Cannabis Investing Part 3 with Julian Lin and James Baker. And look for some of your favorite MSO CEOs coming on the show also in the coming days and weeks. Until then, I hope you enjoy our conversation with Graham Farrar, president and co-founder at Glasshouse Group and CEO of Glasshouse Farms. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice of any sort. I am Long Trueleaf, Chiron, Istrakhan Biosciences, the parent company, Air Wellness, and the ETF MSOS. You can subscribe to us on Libsyn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and Stitcher. Graham, welcome to the Cannabis Investing Podcast. Super happy to have you on the show. Welcome back. Great to have you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having us. Always a pleasure.
It is always a pleasure. And I feel like each time I talk to you, we're speaking some kind of new iteration. This is like the most wide scope, I think, since I've talked to you. But for listeners that don't know Glasshouse Group, that don't know your formidable entrepreneurial background and how you've arrived at this point, catch us up a little bit with where you've been with Glasshouse, kind of when you started and where you are now, which is a very, very exciting time to be, especially when this episode is released. There's going to be a lot of fanfare, and I think a lot more people will know who you are. But so catch us up.
Yeah, sure. It's a really exciting time. I mean, it's really exciting for the whole industry, and we're happy to be a part of it. So Glasshouse Group is a combination of Glasshouse Farms and a number of dispensaries and brands that we had. So we rolled those up into one entity. We started Glasshouse Farms maybe even 7 years ago. So at least on the licensed legal side of the market, we are one of the oldest kids in the candy shop, so to speak. We're also one of the largest, or certainly one of, or if not the largest single a greenhouse grower in California. We have a 500,000 square feet of licensed and operational greenhouse. We have 4 stores, which I think probably puts us in the top 5 in terms of retail chains, which gives you an idea of still how immature. I sometimes say the California market's the oldest, but it's also one of the most immature. And that's, I think, part of the opportunity here. And then we have 3 brands, Glasshouse Farms, which is our kind of premier, flower brand, Bella Thorne's Forbidden Flowers, which we developed with her, and then recently Mama Sue, which is a really neat health and wellness brand that we did in partnership with Sue Taylor, a 70-year-old African-American woman, former Catholic school priest turned cannabis advocate. And it's really fun to be able to help push something like that forward, because I do think there's so much that cannabis can do to help people feel better with plants. And so we like supporting that kind of stuff as well.
And talk to us about what you have coming up this week and kind of how you're coming to market, because there's, been so much talk about the California market. I myself have talked a bunch about the California market. I myself am excited about what's happening in the California market. I think there's been some exciting moves being made. We've been talking the parent company, you guys have a deal with them. I've been talking to John Sandelman through his Air Wellness, but he has also his Mercer Park also did a deal with you guys, coming to the public markets. Like, catch us up on where you, I guess, I want to take it piece by piece. I don't want to overwhelm you or myself with this question, but I guess kind of how, and I forgot to mention, I mean, how you've been, where you've come from on the past on the show is through Cadiz, you know, growing cannabis for hemp at scale. And I think something that's actually, and I'm already getting ahead of myself, see, you know, something that you've learned how to grow at scale, I would imagine from that. So maybe what I'm trying to say is, how do you see the trajectory that you've built in California up until now? And what is the trajectory you see through those deals moving forward, at least how you see it at this point?
Yeah. So, you know, I think to back up a step, you know, Glasshouse Group is one of the largest vertically integrated California cannabis company. When we say vertically integrated, we really mean it. We have every single license type that for cannabis that you can have in California. We have manufacturing labs, we have retail, we have delivery, we have nursery, processing, cultivation, you know, everything. I guess the only exception is a compliance testing lab license, which we don't have because we're not allowed to, because we have the other ones, right? And I think California is, to me, the most exciting market in cannabis, bar none, right? I mean, it is, A, it's the fifth largest economy in the world. B, it's the largest cannabis market in the world. It's probably north of 25% of the entire United States. It's more than twice as big as the next biggest market. It's almost as big as the next three markets combined. And it's, you know, California is a cultural capital for many things, but it is true, you know, really, truly the cultural capital for cannabis, right? Like, that you could probably count the non-California cannabis brands, you know, on a couple fingers, right? And I think it's interesting. It's the appellation that customers care about. It's like where the trends are set, right? I mean, if you think about parallels, you think about like surfwear, right? So surfing happens all over the world. It is very hard to come up with a surf brand that's not from California, right? And you could, you know, Quiksilver, Billabong, like, you know, Revuca, you could keep going down the list, right? And cannabis is kind of similar, right? Which is it is the nexus. It's the breeding ground for cannabis, cannabis culture and products across the planet. And, but yet it's, you know, it's one of these really kind of, you know, immature, still developing markets at the same time that it's the biggest and one of the biggest opportunities. So everything that we're doing is brand focused and product focused. And for that, being in California is actually really an advantage, right? California is a hard market. The kind of the prevailing narrative is California is hard and nobody makes money in California. So the first part is true. California is a hard market. The second part, not true. We have, you know, three going on four positive EBITDA quarters. So we are profitably growing California cannabis brands, which is something that not very many people can say. But that hardness is actually, I think, a real strategic advantage, right? If your goal is to build products, then you need a free market with consumer choice so that you can get the feedback on when you're right about a product and, more importantly, when you're wrong, right? So for a lot of the other states, right, the MSOs and the limited license state, it is it's a fantastic accomplishment to get a license, right? Because there's only four of them, for example. Once you have that, though, from a product point of view, you're still in a quasi-monopoly or a vacuum, right? So yes, you might have the best product of four, right? But that's like a little bit sometimes like being the best, you know, player on your elementary school soccer team, right? Like, yes, that's the best, but that doesn't mean that you can just, you know, that you can go right to the World Cup. California, on the other hand, is the World Cup, right? It's the free market. It is what the future of all these markets are going to look like. And so knowing that you know, here the accomplishment is actually making a product that consumers buy once and then want to buy again and again. And with our goals on making products, that's really the market that we want to be in. Plus, of course, the size. Plus, we do, you know, believe that interstate commerce is going to happen. And so as those walls come down and consumers can get what they want, we know what they want already, right? Like, the illicit market it can be thought of as a free and very large focus group. And it tells us they want California cannabis across the country. When you go to a bodega, for example, in New York, right? Like, the secret menu, Florida's closer. Colorado's been around longer, but it's not stocked with Florida or Colorado. It's stocked with California because that's what consumers want. Just like you probably don't have a favorite non-Mexican tequila. Most people, if they given the choice, they pick California cannabis. So I think that competitive market, the scale that we are building here, and then the opportunity we believe in the next few years for interstate commerce to kick in is going to allow us to give people what they want, which is California cannabis from a national sized supply chain. And that I think is a really exciting place to be.
So how did you get involved? Like you've had this deal with Cadiz. Those are two totally separate things because they're talking about on the hemp side and you're talking about on the THC side. Like in other words, separating them from any cannabis deal, from any THC cannabis.
Yes. Yeah, so the deal with Cadiz is a joint venture and that is with Glasshouse Group. So that's part of this, but it is hemp side. And the reason for that is a couple of things. One is we view the lens through a cannabinoid product is our, you know, view of the product, of the market, right? Like we think cannabinoids are very exciting and powerful. Many of them can be derived from hemp. Really all of them could be derived from hemp, with the exception of Delta 9 THC. So being able to find ways to scale large scale farming with Cadiz, as long as you're not doing Delta 9, you can do that in hemp and do some really interesting things. 50 state legal today, you know, ability to ship across state lines, ability to do, you know, thousands of acres if we wanted. But I think that ends up, you know, dovetailing together with cannabis. I expect that we will legalize cannabis on a federal level. And so much like we had the farm bill of 2018 for hemp, we're going to see, you know, the MORE Act of 2021 or whatever the date is that will allow those things to converge back together. And so it'll be just a question of how's the most efficient way to produce these cannabinoids, right? And so what we're doing right now is a going public via SPAC deal with Mercer Park. And the reason for that was that we have some very large expansion plans. We're going to add 5.5 million square feet of greenhouse cultivation for cannabis here in California. That's the second largest greenhouse in the United States. It will be the largest greenhouse licensed for cannabis, I believe, as far as I know, on the planet. And really the only way to do such a large transaction was with a SPAC, right? Going public in this market, you might be able to get $80 or $100 million. This greenhouse alone is $120 million cash purchase plus the retrofit. And then we're gonna add to that 17 stores through a merger with Element 7, which is one of the largest retail license holder in the state of California. And all of this is with the goal of brand building, right? So high quality, low cost, large scale cultivation to turn into brands and then have control of the shelf space to make sure that A, we can get the data from that retail to make our entire ecosystem smarter. We can have amazing analytics. It also gives us connection to the customer. And then it also allows us to, you know, guarantee shelf space for our brands so that we can have bud tenders who are educated and understand things and have toured the farms. And, you know, I still believe that most of the people have not walked in the door to a dispensary yet, right? We live in this world where it's very normalized, but it's still not for much of the population. Our goal is to make, you know, the Casamigos of cannabis for the Whole Foods consumer. That's, you know, if you want to just put it in a nutshell. So when these consumers walk in the door, to help educate them, help provide recommendations, collect the data, figure out where their holes, like that's really what this is about, is that large scale, high quality, low cost cultivation turned into products delivered to consumer in the Appalachian of California, which we believe will be the nexus in the proving grounds for brands so that eventually we can take them across the country. And I think eventually probably across the world.
And why did you feel like Mercer Park was the vehicle to do that with, or was the partner to do that with that vehicle?
I think John Sandelman, Jamie Mendola, the two principals of Mercer Park, are a fantastic capital markets team. As you know from AIR, I think AIR is pretty much unarguably the most successful cannabis SPAC to date. John Sandelman was the sponsor of AIR. He was the sponsor of Mercer Park. I mean, you can even look at it. So I think Mercer Park brand SPAC was formed in 2018, right? So many years before the SPAC craze, John was doing it. And when he did it with this one, he called it the brand SPAC because its goal was to make brands, right? Now, you just heard me tell the story of how everything that we're doing is brand and product focused because our goal is to make brands. And so like, you know, you can see there's a very high level of alignment to that. I think a lot of folks thought that brand heavy asset light was going to work, particularly in California. There was a expectation of unlimited license state, commoditization, race to the bottom. And if you look at CPG, brand heavy asset light is the norm, but it assumes that you have a mature supply chain. Cannabis, particularly in California, basically the definition of an immature supply chain. Yes, California is unlimited licenses at the state level, but you can't get a state license without a municipal, so city or county license first. 60% of the municipalities in California still ban cannabis, right? So this idea that there's this, you know, abundant oversupply is kind of a false narrative. I frankly think that the demand side is growing faster than supply side right now. If you look at pricing on the wholesale market, it would support my view. Last year, pricing was probably up 25 to 30%. This year, it looks like it's up another 6 to 10%. So, you know, we can see that more consumption is coming into the market, not a whole lot more supply, particularly on the kind of more premium high-end greenhouse work that we do. And so if you can take that, harness it together with the SPAC, you get the capital markets team of John and Jamie, you get the balance sheet of Mercer Park. We have a $135 million pipe raised at this point, which is bigger than some of the recent IPOs out there, almost, you know, twice as big as some of the recent ones. And to put that together and really harness the ability to get the synergy of that, you know, unicorn of an asset. The greenhouse is truly a one-of-a-kind greenhouse for cannabis. And then put it together with the shelf space that we'll control is, I think, as a one of a kind combination for cannabis, and will go down as an inflection point in how things happen in California.
And talk to us about your deal also with the parent company.
Sure. Yeah. So the parent company was a SPAC, formerly Subversive, and it's also the one that Jay-Z is affiliated with on Monogram. They own Caliva as well as Sisu, a few other assets. And basically the deal that we did with them was a strategic investment and a supply chain deal, right? So they raised quite a bit of money in their SPAC, and they're interested in doing products, which is fine. California is a big market, and there's room for, you know, there should be multiple 800 pound gorillas out there. Currently there's, you know, it's hard to argue there's even one, but basically they looked at the pile of cash that they had and they said, hey, our goal is high quality, low cost, you know, large scale cultivation, right? Which is exactly what we're trying to build. You know, I think the Glasshouse team is arguably one of the best at doing that, right? And it's a very hard thing to do large scale, high quality, and efficiently is a challenge. And so they basically said, hey, these guys, we believe in what they're doing. We knew them from, you know, previous discussions, and said, we want to be a part of that. And part of, you know, how we want to benefit with that is, so they made a $50 million strategic investment into our pipe. And then we made a supply agreement on both cultivation and retail, so that, you know, we will be the team that powers what's going into a large portion of their brands, and then we'll be partners with them on selling it. So I think it's a really exciting deal. It makes a ton of sense for both partners. I think it surprised a lot of people, right? They kind of expected to see us as, you know, the two folks fighting with each other. And when we came out and said, we think it's, you know, there's actually more to go on this from the synergy than more in cooperation than competition on this front, I think a lot of people kind of open their eyes, because it really did clear the lane for us on the large scale cultivation side. There's not somebody else who's well-funded and capitalized and has a team to really go head to head on what we're building with this new Southern California greenhouse.
Yeah. I mean, I would say anybody paying attention, any cannabis investors that have been paying attention were like, whoa, Glasshouse Group. Okay. You are out there doing it. I mean, if anything, I would describe it as like a win-win-win scenario, it seems to me. And for me, okay, so here's like a few of my follow-up points. One is Michael Orbach, the chairman of the parent company, he's been on the show a couple of times, and I saw that he tweeted that the ticker symbol for the parent company, which is GRAMF, that was like his love letter to you, trying to get you. Have you guys been in discussions for a long time? Was that always, has he been courting you? Did Mercer Park win out? Was this the kind of like, you kind of didn't break anybody's heart and made everybody happy? Is this that deal?
Yeah, I mean, I think we did find a way to put all the pieces together that's very accretive for everyone. We, you know, Glasshouse talked to everybody out there in the market. And I think, you know, we had a real vision for what we wanted to do, right? And part of that was we wanted to stay in control of the ships, but so to speak, right? We were looking for a fundraising. We weren't looking for a buyout. So we're not taking a single dollar off the table as part of this transaction, which is somewhat rare for SPACs. So we're all in, the management team's all in, myself and my partner, you know, two of the largest guys on the cap table. And we're, you know, all for the next chapter, right? So that, I think that was kind of unique. Also, we didn't, a lot of times SPACs are used to kind of assemble a couple pieces together. We were less about that. We kind of felt like we had a formula that was working, and we wanted to add a, you know, scale it up, to add a zero behind it. So we were looking for financing, and then we had a couple assets that we wanted to acquire that, you know, very large. I mean, $120 million wire will go out to buy this farm, another, you know, $40 million in capex up front, right? Those are big numbers and not traditionally doable without a SPAC type financing. So it was really a matter of getting all the pieces to align. Governance, we wanted to stay in control. The balance sheet needed to be big enough to allow this transaction to happen. We needed somebody that we trusted in the capital markets. The Subversive team and Michael in particular are great. And we're really happy that we got a chance to figure out how to, you know, we got to have our cake and eat it too a little bit, I think. So made everybody really happy to be able to fit these pieces together.
And do you have a vision of like how those synergies keep working more and more together in the California market? Like you said, there's room for a couple, you know, 800 pound gorillas. Do you think that there's room for one, like, you know, 2-ton size gorilla? Like, is that kind of where we're heading? How do you see it playing out?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, you know, of course, candidly, I hope that that's us. And I think what we're building on the supply chain side makes that a reasonable hope to have. You know, somebody needs to consolidate this down. Like, I have a lot of respect for what happened and how we got here in the industry. And there's a lot of people with arrows in their back. We were early on, there's plenty of people before us. And if they hadn't been, you know, helping blaze the trail, there's no chance that we'd be here. That said, the market does, you know, for the fifth largest economy in the world, will need to evolve. You're not going to have something that big that's run off of, you know, something like 80% of the farms in California right now are sub 20,000 or 20,000 square feet or less, which is, you know, half an acre, right? A supply chain that's that fragmented won't be able to support this market. So, you know, I think that we can start to enable that consolidation to brand heavy and asset light, where you can have brands that can get dependable supply. And I think, you know, if you don't have a better team than us, a better asset than us, or live in a better climate than us, and, you know, at least one and probably two of those, it's going to be pretty hard to make an argument why you can deliver higher quality at lower cost and at, you know, a bigger scale. So, you know, someone said to me the other day, it's like, oh, well, you know, all the alcohol companies, they're all divesting their bottling companies and their shipping companies, and they don't own stores. And I, you know, I kind of looked at him and said, you know, yes, but isn't inherent with the fact that they're divesting them, didn't that mean that they owned them first? You can't sell them if you didn't own them, right? So yes, at T plus 96 years from the end of alcohol prohibition or whatever the exact math is, the alcohol companies are divesting. But considering that we're at T minus 2 years or 3 years to the end of cannabis prohibition, who do I outsource to, right? Who's bigger? Who can do it better than we are? Who has more stores? Who has a larger cultivation? Nobody, right? So the only way that we're going to be able to create the brands and the products we want is if we build the whole supply chain to do it, because there is nobody else big enough to, you know, meet the vision that we have. So I think we've got all the right pieces. I'm super excited. You know, as I said earlier, like on a macro level, I think more excited than I've ever been. On a micro level, probably as stressed out as we've ever been, because there's just so many moving pieces right now. But I think they're all, you know, the fundamental building blocks and the logistics of the right climate, the right facility, the right team, right appellation, California, like all those pieces are things that, you know, they don't necessarily all fit to, you know, it's hard work to do it, but they're also the kinds of pieces that you can't change, right? If you have the wrong climate, you're not changing that. If you have the wrong team, maybe you can evolve it, but it's pretty hard. So I think we really do have all the fundamental building blocks to make this work.
Yeah. I mean, I think like as you're starting this up, I would imagine that it's, you know, it's so overwhelming in terms of the growth and the scaling that's involved at this stage, especially. I'm curious, when you started Glasshouse Group, I mean, you're an entrepreneur by spirit in your background. I've talked to you a few times on the podcast. I also talked to you on a webinar once, and I always say, since you did the deal with Mercer Park and everybody knows your name now, not just me. Not just kidding. I wasn't the only one who knew your name. But now that everybody knows your name, you know, and people are talking Graham Farrar and Glasshouse, and I always tell the story that on that webinar, people totally in the business were saying that they have your cannabis like in their bag, in their, you know, in their hands, ready to take after the webinar. So I always feel like that's a testament to the kind of, not just the amount of cannabis you're growing, but the kind of cannabis you're growing and the place that it has in the marketplace. How much did you envision this scope, this scale, when you started, and how much has it been kind of step by step? Like, was Cadiz a big marker along the way, like in terms of developing and then seeing how that could grow from there? Or was it, talk to us about kind of how that grew.
Yeah. I mean, so I, you know, I certainly couldn't say that I would, when, you know, six, 7 years ago when we started the first farm, that, you know, we could envision this, right? Like, that would be a stretch,
but
my fundamental belief is that the world's a better place with cannabis in it. And, there's a Martin Luther King Jr. quote that I like, which is the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. So I did always have the belief that we would stop, you know, we would make progress towards ending the war on drugs, which is not, I don't believe, truly a war on drugs. It was really a war on people and specific people at that. It was very ineffective as a war on drugs, but unfortunately was very effective as a war on people. And this is a step in bringing that chapter to an end, which is, you know, legalizing cannabis, recognizing that the natural state of a plant is not to be illegal, recognizing that people who are, you know, over 21 should be able to decide and have more freedom over what they put in their body, recognizing that there's a tremendous amount of promise that we owe it to ourselves to research around this plant and cannabinoids in general. And, you know, I live in a spot where I get to see a lot of the benefit that cannabis brings, you know, on the medical side, as well as just, you know, personal enjoyment and the jobs and taxes and, you know, et cetera, hopefully value creation for shareholders as well. And it's on the one hand, very, you know, fulfilling to see like how much joy it brings. There's the other part though, which is to think about how much pain it has caused. And so, you know, I think this is part of what we can do to help get us back on a track that makes the world a better place, which is to say, I didn't know how it was going to play out, but I always thought that it was a positive addition to society. And I'm excited that it's playing out like this, right? Which is, I think we are, you know, you got Chuck Schumer tweeting out that 420 is a national holiday. You have, you know, Mexico on the verge. Canada did it already, right? It's going to be one state after another. It took us 50 years to get to 12 states of having adult legal cannabis. And then it took 8 months to increase that number by 30%, right? Like the flood is coming. And just, I think, like the end of alcohol prohibition helped pull our country out of the Great Depression, I think the end of cannabis prohibition can help, you know, get the economy restarted after the pandemic. So, you know, we're really excited to be a part of that. Lots of milestones on the way. Cadiz is a huge one. The ability to scale like that with, you know, can't people forget, you know, hemp is cannabis, right? It's, It may be the Chihuahua to the THC St. Bernard, but at the end of the day, they're both dogs, and there's a lot of things that you can do with each one. And so, you know, our goal is to build a national or global size supply chain to bring more cannabinoid products to more people, because we think it makes the world a better place. And all the pieces of that are really exciting to be able to put together.
So do you spend time thinking about kind of the particulars of how that picture develops, the legalization picture? Like, you know, you're talking about Schumer, you know, there was an announcement that the MORE Act is going to the House. Do you feel like it's going to be this year that the MORE Act passes, or you're not so concerned, or it's impossible to know exactly when it happens? You're just kind of sure that this is the direction and it's going to be legalized, and where and when interstate commerce figures in, or where and when 280E gets repealed and something else gets added, or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, my friend Jason Wild, the CEO or acting CEO of TerrAscend, I think said it well, which is, you know, there's a lot of that kind of stuff that as an individual, like, I can't influence. So, you know, accept the things that you can't change and work hard on the things that you can. So all of our plans actually assume that the walls stay up, right? None of our models or forecasting is like, here's the date that, you know, interstate commerce happens. I do think it will happen, but one of the nice things about being in California is that it's the largest market on the planet by itself. So if you're going to be in a spot, this is the best spot to be in. And if Chuck Schumer says, you know, it's go time on interstate commerce, we'll, you know, we'll turn the dial to 11. We'll run it faster than the predictions. If he says, no, this is going to be the one CPG product in the history of the United States that is not going to be sold between states, right? If it's going to be the equivalent of when I go to Montana, I just pick Montana wines. And when I go to New York, it's like, you know, again, you got a favorite non-Mexican tequila brand? Probably not, because that's not how anything else in the world works. So But if that does come to pass, well, California is going to develop there. I think the California market could triple in size just by the cannibalization of the illicit market by the legal market, right? Like the embedded upside in this market is giant. I think we have a whole new set of customers that are going to start walking in the door. We saw the front end of that through the pandemic, right? We always had the fun on a Friday night customer, but then we got the tincture on Tuesday customer too, right? When your kids came home for spring break and didn't leave for a year. And when you're watching the news and case counts and the charts were all pointing to the sky, like there's a lot of people who found relief and help sleeping and anxiety and all kinds of stuff. And I don't think that doesn't ever turn back, right? Like if you discover that a cannabis tincture can help you sleep better than a sleeping pill, you don't unlearn that, right? And maybe hopefully you don't need it as much as the pandemic backs off, but it doesn't mean you don't know it, right? And when you recommend it to someone who's having sleep, it's like, you know, we've had this in a box for so long, and I think the chains are really going to come off it, and it's going to, you know, it's going to continue to develop. And that said, I think we got Kamala Harris, who's a lead sponsor, is a deciding vote in the Senate and the vice president. We have Chuck Schumer, who was very vocal and, you know, somewhere around staking his legacy on getting this done. And I think, you know, it's easy for us on the business side to forget that there's a more important, higher priority piece than the business piece. And that's the social justice side of this, right? Like the MORE Act at its core is as much as it should be about social justice and not continuing to put people in jail and tear families apart over a plant, right? And like that shouldn't wait, right? Like even if you have to put the business piece aside, like we should fix that. We should expunge things. People should not go to jail for a plant. Families should not be torn apart for a plant. We shouldn't waste taxpayer money on treating, you know, if there's someone has a drug issue, it's a health issue, not a criminal issue, right? If they're a nonviolent person, what are we doing treating them like this? And so I think there's an urgency to that, which won't be denied. And that probably means that this gets done sooner rather than later.
Here. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, talking about this notion of brands and building that out in the marketplace, how do you envision what a brand or what a successful brand is? Like, what do you think the things that go into it are? Because, you know, it's talked about a lot, like, you know, dominating the brand space and becoming a powerful brand. And I think people say some slightly different things about like what that even means, and also mm-hmm. what the power of the brand is for consumers also, you know, like what it means. Is it like a consistent experience? Is it cool packaging? You know, is it a combination of a few things? Like, how do you see it? Is it a strategic supply chain? How do you see it in terms of like developing and thinking about, you know, scaling powerful, a house of powerful brands?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always going to be a lot of answers to that because there's a lot of demographics and use cases that you're talking to. I mean, I always use tequila as my example, but the same could apply to beer or wine, right? Like tequila's fermented from agaves, and it's, you know, all somewhat similar, right? It's a related thing, but there's lots of brands out there at different price points and for different uses. You know, I call us the Casamigos of cannabis because I think we're kind of that everyday luxury, right? Like, you know, 1942 is probably my favorite tequila, but I would never put it in a margarita. I don't drink it, you know, on a, you know, casual Tuesday night dinner. It's more like, you know, special occasions, graduations, you sip it, et cetera. That's not actually what you always want, right? You want the choice. You want the spectrum of things. Sometimes you want that for a birthday party, and sometimes you want that for, you know, tacos on a Tuesday. And so I think there will continue to be that diversification. One thing I do think, and you mentioned, is consistency. It's like consistency is almost the essence of a brand, right? If you can't be consistent, what is a brand, right? Like, you know, pick Starbucks, whether you like or don't like Starbucks, it is always the same thing. Is, you know, the experience you're going to get, whether you're in, you know, Tel Aviv or Los Angeles, you're going to get the same cup of coffee, and that's what makes it a brand. Now, you may like it or not, but that's up to you. The brand is consistent. And if you went in there and sometimes it was amazing and sometimes it was absolutely horrible, you probably would quit going. Like, you'd get three horribles in a row and you'd say, I'm out, right? And so I think that consistency is really important. I also think the scale is important. Certainly there's plenty of niche tequilas and wines and things like that, but you know, on the large scale brand side, being able to service the market with, you know, so our philosophy at Glasses is quality, consistency, and cost, right? First, you got to do it great. Then you got to do it great every time. Then you got to do it great every time efficiently, i.e. at a reasonable cost so that you can deliver value to the consumer. I mean, I think with Glasshouse Farms, we finished 2020 as the number two flower brand in the state of California. Flower is the largest category. California is the largest market. So that's actually, you know, you could say the flower brand of flower category in California is probably like 15% of the total U.S. market. If you look at it, you know, half of 25%, you know, it's somewhere in that neighborhood. And I think the way that we did it not is not by fancy packaging. Packaging matters, but you buy the products for what's inside the packaging, right? Like you don't buy Nike shoes for the orange box. That just helps you find the Nike shoes. You don't buy an iPhone for the amazing packaging that Apple does. That's just part of the experience. So it, the packaging is good, but it's not, you know, that was not the inflection point. I think the inflection point was, you know, I said to our product team, like, make this undeniable, right? Like, I want a great product at a fantastic price. And because we work off of our own cultivation COGS and it's not spot market COGS, we can do that, right? 95% of brands in California, there's probably 1600 brands, 95% of them don't have a supply chain, which means they have to go to the market and buy something and then figure out how to add packaging and testing and distribution, sales and marketing, and then have a product, you know, a price that they can sell it. So they have variable input cost, fixed selling price. It's a tough place to be. Usually what happens, they see what they want, and then they add all the prices up and realize they can't sell it at retail for that price. So then they scale it back and they say, okay, well, the good flower was $1,300 a pound. What can I get for $600? Well, it's not as good. So now you're stuck trying to sell that. Whereas we can go to, you know, our cultivation COGS and just put the price where we thought it should be undeniable. And the market told us they agreed with it. So I think we're going to want to keep doing that. Our platform that we're building, I think, will be fantastic for M&A. It'll be fantastic for brand building because it's got the fundamental pieces of high quality produced at a, you know, at a efficiently, at a good, you know, reasonable cost and at large enough scale to service a market the size of California and then eventually the rest of the country.
And who do you rely on in terms of, you know, the growing and the cultivation? Like, who on your team have you put around you in terms of, you know, advising you on that side and being in charge of that side of things?
Yeah, so the approach I've always used is kind of is the hybrid, right? Which is there's 25-year cannabis guys and there's 25-year greenhouse guys. There aren't really 25-year cannabis greenhouse guys. I think, you know, those guys would be in jail. So, you know, we took some of the 25-year cannabis guys and some of the 25-year greenhouse guys and, you know, or people, I should say. We actually have a one of our new head growers is just promoted as a woman. So it's cool to see, you know, increasing representation of that in this industry as well. But basically, we marry them together at work, right? Like, you know, this plant, you know, the operations, you know, figure out how to do this really well. And it's not, you know, we certainly don't know the right answer to everything. You know, someday we don't know what to do, but we know a lot of things not to do. And sometimes that can be even more valuable. And again, it's not that we got everything right, but we started long enough ago. You know, twice we've converted now, we've converted two non-cannabis greenhouses to cannabis. Twice we've tripled in size, right? And so the mistakes that maybe you saw people make in Canada, for example, right, is they thought they were a good grower, and they were, but growing in this, you know, for this plant is only half of it, right? It's cannabis is a lot more like making wine than it is like growing vegetables, right? You don't pick the tomato and put it in the box and you're done. It's, well, you've grown it right. Now you got to harvest it right, and you got to dry it and cure it and process it and trim it, and had to pick the right genetics, right? And so it's a lot more like a winemaking progress. You know, there's an example in Canada where somebody up there who was arguably, I'm sure, was a good grower. They planted 40 acres or whatever, and they didn't realize that in 8 weeks they were going to need 500 people to harvest that, right? And so the whole crop died, right? Died in the greenhouse. That's not a mistake that we will make, right? Not because we didn't ever make it. We just did it 5,000 square feet, right? So that we don't need to do it at 5 million. But you know, we may not know the answer to every question, but at least we know the questions that we need the answers to, because we've been doing it at large scale for long enough now that we have some sense of what's coming for us. So, you know, I think that's that team, you know, at the end of the day, that's the most important piece, right? A company is just a group of individuals with a common goal working together on something. So if that's not solid, it's hard to accomplish much.
Yeah. Talk to like cannabis investors a little bit. I mean, there's an interesting moment in the marketplace where I think there's never been more exciting players to look at. And the strength of those players, I would include what you're bringing to the marketplace as one of them. And yet share prices are kind of all over the place, very volatile. Some people are freaked out. Some people are doubling down and buying all the dips. And how do you look at it, and how would you advise investors in this space, especially in this time where I feel like we're about to turn something, you know, like how do you look at it, and how do you talk about it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm personally a fundamentals person. And by fundamentals, I mean more like the kind of underlying building blocks, right? Like I believe in cannabis, and I think people should, right? I don't think it's a fad. I don't think it's going away. I think it's going, you know, up and to the right. And so from there, if you believe in the market and you believe in a trajectory where it's going to have, you know, continued loosening restrictions and a wider total addressable market, and there's going to be growth, then it becomes on, you know, what industry and what jockey, right? And so I think it's one of the biggest capital dislocations out there, right? I mean, you look at the industry and it trades, what do we got, 7x to 11x multiples. You see that in industries that have flat to negative growth, like, you know, an 11x multiple on EBITDA is an alcohol number, or maybe even a tobacco number, right? Like, these are markets that are fully mature, flat to declining, and they get the same EBITDA multiples that cannabis does with almost 100% compounded annual growth, right? Like, that is the definition of the dislocation, right? Like, if you had that in tech, it'd be 40x multiples, right? If you had, you know, some other industry, it'd be, you know, it'd be multiples of the multiple. And so I think that it does, the markets do sort that thing out. You can trade Canadian cannabis companies on a U.S. exchange, and you can trade a U.S. cannabis company on a Canadian exchange, but you can't trade a U.S. company on a U.S. exchange. Like, there's no fundamental sense to that. And eventually markets are good at sorting that stuff out. So I continue to be very long cannabis. I think we're, you know, I don't know if we're in batting practice or the second inning, but we're very early in this game. And I think, you know, it's going to be immensely disruptive to so many things. And I think that's part of what gets me excited, right? Like, you could have legitimate suitors in cannabis from an alcohol company, a tobacco company, a pharma company, a health and wellness company, right? Like, every single one of those deep pocketed industry has a legitimate interest, either defensively or offensively or a combination of the two. And that, you know, I've never seen that before. And, you know, I think, you know, the promise you see on the medical side, the promise you see on the health and wellness side, the promise you see on just the enjoyment side of things, alcohol, alternatives, you know, et cetera, is, you know, unparalleled in anything I've seen. So, you know,
and do you feel
the dislocation is the opportunity?
Yeah. I was going to say, like, speaking of like dislocation, disrupt, you know, kind of, do you feel like that there's anything coming down that might happen legislatively, or how regulations are played out, you know, like the, you know, you talked earlier about the 2018 Farm Bill, which was like met with such fanfare and promise, and it's been, you know, kind of a slow roll and not so perfectly rolled out. Do you see anything that is like troubling to you or feels like might slow out the rollout of what could be of the total addressable market of what have you that you look positively on?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always, you know, plenty of speed bumps, and predicting the future is one of the great challenges, you know, for people. But I would say I'm mostly on the optimistic side of things, right? So, you know, I think something that would be a very bad choice was if they rescheduled cannabis, you know, if they moved it from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2. Mm-hmm. Frankly, I don't think that works, because if you're going to ignore it at Schedule 1, I don't think anyone's going to start paying attention to it at Schedule 2, right? So you're going to have to enforce, which just would be attempting to repeat the failure. If enforcement worked, we wouldn't be having this conversation. You know, drugs would be gone. Cannabis would, they spent 50 years trying to eradicate it. How many billion dollars? So it didn't go away, right? Like, you can't just reschedule it to that. So you're going to have something that syncs up with the 44 or whatever we're at now states that have liberalized their cannabis laws, and Schedule 2 doesn't do that. So that said, I think I'm pretty optimistic, because really this gets into technicalities, but if you consider the Dormant Commerce Clause of the Constitution, It does not allow protectionism between states. And at the end of the day, barring interstate commerce is protectionism between states, right? It is denying the farmer in California the country as a market, which is literally a quote from the Supreme Court that says, you don't do that. We're pretty comfortable protectionism between countries here in the US, but we do not allow protectionism between states. We're one country on the inside. And you know, you can see the early precedents of that being set with the ban, they're striking down the residency requirements. Some states have attempted to have laws where, like, if you want to be, want to get a cannabis license in Massachusetts, you have to be a Massachusetts resident. They challenge those in the court and they fall away because basically you just said, hey, a Massachusetts resident wins and the Florida resident or whoever is disadvantaged, and that doesn't work. And for the same reason, barring interstate commerce doesn't work. I think people have a false notion that the federal government only regulates interstate commerce and not intrastate commerce. They actually regulate both. So there's nothing more okay about the intrastate commerce than interstate commerce. If you want to go down the path of, you know, is any of that allowed to be banned? As soon as they do, the federal government does anything to legalize cannabis, right? I'm not talking about rolling the rules out, even. I'm just talking about, you know, a States Act, a Moore Act, right? All of a sudden, all of these things instantly apply. 280E instantly goes away. Interstate commerce, it just is there. It just becomes a matter of the logistics. And whether it gets sorted out in Congress or it gets sorted out in the courts, I think it's going to get sorted out. People get what they want. What they want is cannabis across the country. And we can do much better than the way we're doing it now. And so I'm pretty optimistic that those things are going to happen sooner rather than later.
And speaking of the national picture, and I'll leave it here, do you have your eye at all on the global picture? I mean, I know you talked about the size of a global supply chain. Are you thinking about the global picture as well?
I mean, certainly, you know, getting to where we want to be in California is enough for right now, and getting to where we want to be for the U.S. is enough for the next couple of years. But, you know, I think, you know, champagne comes from France, right? So yeah. It's at some level, I think that we're going to want to see U.S. cannabis brands are not going to be in the U.S. only, right? Like we will just, again, you know. Do you have a favorite non-Mexican tequila brand, right? Like some things just come from certain places and then they're delivered from those places to the rest of the world. And I think, you know, California is the epicenter of that, but the U.S. is on a broader base is also that. And so I can't imagine a world in this, you know, we may be talking 5-10 years down the road now, but I can't imagine a world where somebody in Portugal can only buy Portuguese cannabis, right? So I do think that we will, cannabis is going to end up looking a lot more like other CPG products than different than other CPG products. I mean, we think we spend a lot of time figuring out how to take our love for this plant and what it can do and how to amplify that. You know, we don't want big to be diluting. We want big to be amplifying. But at the end of the day, it will be a product and people around the planet want it. And so there's going to be, you know, ways for them to get it. I'm sure of it.
Yeah, you talked about rescheduling and the war on drugs, and I feel like the only thing the war on drugs did for cannabis was taught us all that it's not a drug. You know, that it's a plant. It shouldn't be treated as such. Well, Graham, another really great conversation that I very much enjoyed, and I hope listeners will too. I think they will. A lot of excitement. I really appreciate you taking the time and talking to us. If you think there's anything I left out that you want to say, go for it. But thank you so much for joining us and sharing the Glasshouse story and what you guys have going on.
Yeah, my pleasure, Rena. Really happy to be here. I mean, I guess the only other thing to say is, you know, if you want to learn more about Glasshouse, glasshousegroup.com. Mercer Park Brand SPAC is at mercerparkbrand.com. Our DSPAC vote is coming up on 6-2, and we're really excited to be doing all the things we are. And, you know, I think it's just an amazing time for the industry, a lot of hard work, but we're super happy to be here and really appreciate you having us on.
Absolutely. A lot of hard work. Good luck with it. Take some breaths along the way.
Yeah.
And I hope to talk to you soon, Graham. Take care. Enjoy it.
Thanks a lot, Rena. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for listening to the Cannabis Investing Podcast. Subscribe or follow us on Seeking Alpha, Libsyn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or Stitcher. And We'd really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps other investors find our show. If you have feedback or questions, we'd love to hear from you at Rena plus the plus sign CANPOD at seekingalpha.com. That's RENA plus CANPOD at seekingalpha.com. Thanks so much for listening, and see you next time.